Down.
Holding it down and fighting the power. It's power. Breakdown FM. Radio. West Side Eye. With the meaning. West Coast.
Ruthless. My style is a juvenile. Ran with a gang. Slanged in the meanwhile. Banking. I specialize in ganking. White, Mexican brothers and others. Daily. It's all about coming up. Making sure no punks are running up. Because I'm a gangster having fun. Strapped with the gap when I'm walking through Compton.
Compton's in the house.
Easy E, rocking nonstop on the radio. With the funky fresh hip hop and stereo. Releasing rhymes that you would find demanding. With Dre's beats that are so outstanding. I'm getting busy if you know what I mean. Always setting me a mark in the hip hop scene. On the radio, the greatest of all times. Like Muhammad Ali, cause I punch rhymes. So tune your station and clear all the static. And tell the truth, you didn't know that I had it in me to be easy about the situation. So just kick it and listen to the station. Playing my music, it's hard to lose it. It's constantly on request cause you choose it. I'm Easy E, my rap is strong.
You wanna know why? Because
I'm on the
radio. Wait a minute, cut this.
Man, what you gonna do now?
What we gonna do right here is go back.
How far are you going back?
Way back.
As we go a little something like this.
Well, I'm Easy E, I got women galore. You might have a lot of women, but I got much more. With my super duper group coming out to shoot. Easy E, homegirls cold knocking the boots. Cause I'm a hot thugster, I used to be a monster. And if you hurt, you think I own a drugstore. Getting stupid cause I got it like that. And if a sucker talks trash, I give him a
smack.
Eight ball sipping, the women are flipping. Slow down and hit a dipping, continue my tripping. Hitting my switches, collecting my pieces. Keep the money that I make so I can add to my riches. Fill my stash pot and start rubbing my gap. Feeling good as hell cause my pockets are fat. A hard cold feeling cold roaming the streets. And with a homie like Dre just supplying the beats. Because I'm a gangster having fun. Always got the knuckleheads on the run. Hitting like that, I make you ask what was it. Boy, you should have known by now. Easy does it.
Easy does it.
Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon, and sitting in front of me is a legend. This is somebody whose name you probably heard about. Probably not in the best of lights because of the popularity of artists like Ice Cube and Dr. Dre. They didn't have a lot of nice things to say in some of their songs. But as they say, there's another side to the story, and we're here to find out about this gentleman. We're talking about the one and only Jerry Heller, the person who is EZ's right-hand man. And just from reading your new book, Ruthless, we had always heard that Jerry Heller was somebody who hooked up with Eazy-E and had been in the music business for a while. That's what we heard. But once I read the book, and I'm seeing names like Bruce Springsteen and Marvin Gaye, and it's like, you name it, these people popped up. It's like, you was like a real factor in the game. And so before we even get into the whole NWA and Eazy-E thing, let's just kind of familiarize people with you, just so we know just like how you were a factor. Who is Jerry Heller, and how long have you been in this music business game?
Great, Davey, and thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, we got a nice dog here for
you're
people watching on the TV.
One of my favorites. This is Swedish, and she's happy to be here too, but she's sort of a camera hog. So, you know, I started off in the mid-60s, just about the time that rock and roll got started. So my first group was a group called the Standells and a record called Dirty Water, and which was really the first punk, although they didn't call it punk in those days, record, and it went to number one. And then I found the Grassroots. And then sometime a little later, I ran across this group from San Francisco, from Cerrito, called the Gollywogs, which were Creedence Clearwater. Okay. Then in 1969, I brought Elton John to this country. I brought the Guess Who here from Canada for their first tour. I actually brought them here. They were staying in the top floor of the Continental Hyatt House, and that was the weekend of the big earthquake.
Oh, really?
Okay. Because, you know, in Winnipeg, where they were from, it's just like being in Kansas or something, just flat. Then right after Creedence, I brought Pink Floyd here. And then I went in business for myself. See, in my day, most people started off as agents. Now they start off as A&R guys at record companies and stuff.
Now, for people who aren't familiar, what exactly is an agent? Is this somebody who books shows, or were you like a manager? How do you explain an agent?
A good agent is partially he negotiates employment for his clients, whether it be television or radio or tours. But a real good agent gets involved in more than that and starts to help, really becomes almost in a managerial position where he's sort of helping out. So once I went in business for myself, we represented Journey and Styx and REO Speedwagon and Boz Scaggs and Van Morrison, a lot of Bay Area people, Joan Armatrading and Marvin Gaye and the Tops and Martha and the Vandellas and the Miracles and ELO, and it just goes on and on and on.
It's a very impressive list. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Jerry Heller, former right-hand man of Eazy-E for Ruthless Records, and we're finding out the other side of the story, finding out what went on behind the scenes, and talking about his new book, Ruthless. Now, you know, one of the things that I found interesting in the book was it seems like in that period of time, the 60s, it was a who's who of people that all seem to be starting at the same time. I'm hearing names like David Geffen and Clive Davis and Mo Austin and all these names that are like legendary now. But the way that you refer to them in the books, these were like your contemporaries. These are the people that you broke bread with and just seemed to hang out with every day. So with everybody just getting started then and just starting to formulate and lay down the groundwork for what we now see as the music business?
Well, the rock and roll as we knew it then basically started in the mid-60s. And before that, we were just all a bunch of old pot-smoking hippies that didn't know how to make business, didn't know how to make any money. Along came a guy named Bill Graham who taught us how to make money. So I think that Bill Graham probably, to me, who I had a real love-hate relationship over the years, Bill Graham to me is probably one of the most important people in rock and roll. He could do sound better than any sound guy. He could do lights better than any light guy. And he was a great impresario and really the P.T. Barnum of really his era. So I started with Bill. There was Chet Helms at the Avalon in San Francisco. And David Geffen was just getting started. He was an agent like I was. Sandy Gallen. Danny Weiner from Monterey Peninsula Artists. He was just starting out. We all basically, well, of course, now Clive was already the president of Columbia Records. So when we started off, I'm 65 now, and Clive admits to being 72. So remember, he's like 7 to 10 years older than most of us. Mo Austin and Joe Smith, the same things, the Mo and Joe show at Warner Brothers. They started off. They were partners with Frank Sinatra at Reprise and then became, of course, the chairman of Warner Brothers. And then there was Jerry Moss and Herbie Alpert at A&M. And there was Jack Holtzman at Elektra, who had Janis Joplin and The Doors and Jim Morrison and people like that. So they were just a little ahead of us. I always said that Clive Davis, who I consider probably one of the top 2, 3, 4, 5 people in the history of the music business, he's an amazing guy. He believed in me before I believed in me. So he gave me my first label, I think, in 1970 or 71 when he was still the president of Columbia. And on that label, I had Glencoe, which was the average white band. And I had a group called Sweet Thursday, which was Nicky Hopkins, who was like the sixth stone, Bobby Objodgers and Alan Davies from Cat Stevens, and John Mark and Johnny Allman, who their most famous record was the Sausalito Bay Suite. They were some old jazz guys from England, not that old. They were my age. But they did that Sausalito Bay Suite, which was the first really jazz rock kind of fusion kind of record, and they were spectacular. So we all, you know, there we were, and that was the beginning of rock and roll.
And that was also the foundation which a lot of the music business was based upon. And interestingly enough, when I'm reading this in your book, you know, most of us weren't even born in those years. So, you know, we're talking about maybe a decade or so later.
Rub it in.
You know, but, you know, we got to know the history, you know, at least part of it. But I think the other thing which is very interesting in this book
is like you talk about a lot of the things that went on behind the scenes with NWA. And of course, you know, within the context of that, we hear about the gangsters and, you know, the type of, you know, unsavory parts that went on in the business. What I found pretty interesting in your book is that, you know, you at least you allude to it in many instances, that it was pretty rough and rugged when you all started. You know, we don't often hear that story. I mean, you're talking about, you know, some of these agencies, everybody's all mobbed up and they're connected and people had their temper tantrums and what have you. So it seems like to me, and maybe I don't know if this was the intention, so I'll ask you, but it was kind of interesting to read how the rap industry is and then to have it juxtaposed with your experience in the rock and roll and not see that there wasn't a whole lot of difference in terms of the rough and tumble tactics that the music industry can bring about.
Well, remember, Davey, that there were two things that were different. First of all, we're talking about the 60s, the era of discontent. Country was getting ready to go to war in Vietnam. The president was, Nixon was a crook. You know, it was a whole different time. There was, basically, people were marijuana smokers in those days, and marijuana smokers are basically mellow people. So no matter what happened, people always played by the rules in those days. If you got in a fight with somebody, okay, you knocked him down or he knocked you down, you got up, you hugged each other, you shook hands, and you had a drink together and smoked a joint, and everybody was cool with everything. Of course, that changed, you know, later on in the rap business. So even though there were lots of mob guys involved, it just didn't have the ominous kind of presence that we face since, I would say, the insurgence of Suge Knight onto the scene.
Really?
It was something changed everything, of course.
Cool. You know, I'm thinking to myself as I'm reading this, you know, the five heartbeats and things like that where people were dangled out of balconies and shook down for their money and all that. So that's what I'm thinking as I'm reading this. Like, I'm going, oh, wow, you know, here are some of these players and they were just as grimy. So you're saying it was very, very different in that sense, or that you didn't have those type of encounters or people who would at least try to bring that about? Maybe they might have been more classy about it.
Well, I think that there were those encounters. You know, you hear all those old stories about Nat Tarnopol holding Jackie Wilson out of a window and stuff. But basically, that was just the exception rather than the rule, and it was more a New York kind of trip. It was never happening, you know, out on the coast. And I don't think that we really had any of that in rock and roll. Maybe in the old R&B days, where it was basically a cash business and guys were getting brown bags full of money and stuff. Maybe those things went on. But I've always found that when I dealt with Morris Levy, who, of course, has passed away and was the godfather of rock and roll, especially in New York, that he was willing to play by the rules as long as you were willing to play by the rules.
Okay, what were those rules, you know?
The rules were, you know, that he would set it out. And you know that, like, I remember I had a big hit with Tommy James and the Shondells called Hanky Panky, and I went over to see Morris Levy, and I said to him, look, you know, we're at 4 million units, and I want to up his deal, and I want you to give him an advance and stuff like that. And he said, and he had a couple of guys in the room with him, and I was just a kid. So, and I said, he said, what do you want? I said, I want 16 points. I want Tommy to leave with a check now for 250 or 500,000 or whatever it was, which was a lot of money at the time. And he said to me, listen, kid, I don't pay 16 points. I said, I know, but see, it's like a new day, Mr. Levy, and that's what he deserves, and that's what he should get. And he said, okay, if you want 16 points, you got it, but I'm only paying you on 10. You know, so, you know, later on, the rules changed a little, and the rules with guys like David Geffen and Mo Austin and Clive Davis were that within the boundaries of common decency, you could yell and you could scream, but these guys were now approaching the level of, if not being billionaires, at least multi-millionaires, and they didn't care if you yelled at them, they didn't care if you screamed at them. You know, it's just like Three guys go to town, go fly into the Boston airport. One guy takes the water taxi to the hotel. One guy takes a cab and goes one way. One guy gets a rental car and goes somewhere else. And they all end up at the same hotel. Some people are screamers. Some people are wheedlers and beggars. Some people are negotiators. Everybody has a different style, and all of those styles are acceptable. When you start turning over desks on people and pistol-whipping guys, that changes the game. And what it does is that these guys at Universal and Warner Brothers who have private security forces and stuff, you're never going to get to see them again. I remember once Norman Whitfield, who to me is one of the most talented people of the entire R&B era. I mean, the man wrote Papa Was a Rolling Stone. He wrote the biggest song in the history of the world. It was number one 6 times. I heard it through the grapevine. I remember one day he went in and he turned over David Berman, who was then the head of business affairs at Warner Brothers. He turned over his desk on him. Well, the next week, from having a whole floor at Warner Brothers, he had a little office in the corner, and they repossessed his studio equipment, and basically he put himself really out of the music business by doing that. See, that's unacceptable in the music business.
Yo, Dre, kick in the bass!
And do me a favor.
It all happened and the guy tried to choke her. Push her, didn't care, she ain't nothing but a smoker. That's the way it goes, that's the name of the gang. Young brother living dumb by slanging cane. Going around his neck in 14K heaven. Girls on his jock about 24-7. He won't live long, just keep on waiting. Dope man dies cause he had fresh dates. Living in Captain California, CA. Three went to jail cause the police pulled the rein. To be a dope man, it's a life of grief. Best days on the 1st and 15th. Got a lot of money, nothing less than a 20. Yo, you want a 5? Oh, the dope man's got plenty. To be a dope man, boy, you must qualify. Don't get high off your own supply. From a key to a G, it's all about money. 10-piece, 410, bass pipe comes free. And people out there not hip to the fact. If you see somebody getting money for crack, he's the dope
man. We're talking to Jerry Heller, former right-hand man for EVE and NWA and Ruthless Records, and we're just getting a little bit of history about the music business, because it's something that you talk about in a lot of detail in your book, Ruthless. One of the questions I did have is that, you know, you take somebody like Bill Graham, for example, you know, who I got to know was a nice guy when I met him, but people said that, you know, back in the days that they played rough and rugged in the sense that folks would try to really lock down their territories. Like, you couldn't just do a concert unless you were really rolling with Bill, or you had an equal or amount of resources to withstand the type of business tactics that people would use. And even in your book, you talk about, you know, being very hardcore when it came to the negotiating. And just having worked at places like Clear Channel and others, and seeing how those types of rough and tumble tactics can come, you know, being blackballed, you know, being pushed out, forced out, economically punished, those types of things. Were those in existence in the 60s? I mean, did you all play by those rules? Because it seems like those are the types of foundations that my experience in the music business is how I see a lot of people play it to the hilt, which, you know, leads us to the conclusion that a lot of times when we say the only thing that is more grimier than the music business is the political arena.
Remember now that when you're talking about Bill Graham, he's the man that invented the personal appearance as we know it today. San Francisco was his city. Now, you can't just go into his city and do concerts. He's going to do what he has to do to make sure that you don't go in competition with him there. Now, I would say this to you, just like I once said it to some of the Panthers, who I came across quite often, and we had a very cordial relationship.
I'm about the Black Panther.
You're in my home right now. If you tell me that you want my home, then there's only one way that you can get it. And I'm not sure that that's something that you want to undertake. If you tell me you like my house and you'd like one like mine, then I'm going to do whatever I can do to help you get that. But my house is my house, and I'm going to defend it. And Bill Graham's house was Bill Graham's house, and he did what he had to defend it. Now, with Bill Graham, when he made a deal, he always lived up to it. And that's the way I was. I negotiated tough. I made sure all the T's were crossed and the I's were dotted. But once I made a deal, I always lived up to it. Always be wary of somebody that says, hey, man, that's cool, and whatever you want. And see, that isn't the way business is. Anybody that tells you, and that deal is too easy, that means they have no intention of living up to their part of the deal. So when a guy says that to you, another thing that guys used to say to me as an agent is, money's no problem. Well, that's crazy. Money is always the problem in any deal. And anybody that tells you anything different, I don't care if you're dealing with Summer Redstone or you're dealing with Clive Davis, money is always the problem in a deal. That's why people fight over it. The difference is that once you make the deal, you know how you intend to live up to your part of the contract. And Easy and I always lived up scrupulously to our part of the deal.
Right, talking about EVE, you know, one of the things in about the book, and I think you said that you felt like this is the most important book to come along about the music industry, because you talk a little bit about these negotiating things, and the fact, I guess, what I liked about reading in it was you said that the deal was made before you even start to roll the actual proceedings out. In other words, it's in the negotiating and all that behind the scenes. And do you think people have not learned those lessons, or have they learned them and exceeded in today's environment?
Well, some people have learned them and some people haven't. Because, well, first of all, let me just go back for a second. Remember now, at the time that Ruthless was becoming enormously successful, there was another company that sold more records than we did called Delicious Vinyl. They had Young MC. They had Tone Loke. I mean, they sold lots of records because their people didn't really understand how to make deals. We prospered, and they went out of business, and they sold more records than we did. So that's always an important factor, is the understanding and negotiating of deals. And one thing that Easy got from me was that I was already 20 years older than most of the guys in rap. I had been through it on the highest levels of white rock and roll. So what I brought to the table was my ability to negotiate deals with David Geffen and Mo Austin and Clive Davis and people like that at the very highest levels. Bob Krasnow, Sylvia Roan. So, you know, I was at that stage, and that's what I brought to the table. And Easy knew that, and that's why he sought me out.
Yeah, what we're going to do is we're going to take a break for a second. I want to come back and talk about how you hooked up with EVE and how the whole NWA explosion came and why you call that group the Black Beatles. So when we return, we'll continue our conversation. We're talking with Jerry Heller, the other side of the story about NWA. We'll be right back.
Monkey, like the beat funky, nickname Eazy-E, yo, 8-Ball Junkie. Bass drum kicking and a snag at night. And if it ain't rap, then you know it's crap. Crowd rocking, sucker socking from around the way. Got a six shooter, yo, mean I'm brave. E-boning out to find the boys to kick dust and cut, crank up some noise. Police on my tail, I don't like jail. 40 ounce in my lap and it's cold as hell. Hook a right turn and let them go up. Then I say to myself, they can kiss my butt. If they get drunk, got the 8 in my lips. Put in the old tape, Marvin Gaye's greatest hits. Rolling so hard, had the bass cold romping. Cruising through the east side, south of Compton. See a big butt, and I say word. I took a look at her face, and the girl was to the curb. But she was on my tip for the title I'm holding. Easy E's getting busy. he got the 8-ball rolling.
We're back. David D hanging out with you this afternoon. If you just tune in and if you're watching, we're talking with Jerry Heller. He's the man, the myth, the legend, you know, the right-hand man to Eazy-E and Ruthless Records. And before we went to break, I was talking about the fact that you referred to N.W.A. as the Black Beatles. And in your book, you go into a lot of painstaking detail to talk about this relationship that you had with Eazy-E. And I guess the first question that would come to a lot of people is, how does a guy from Compton, Jerry Curl, 5'2", hook up with a tall Jewish guy from Cleveland who's been in the rock and roll field for, you know, forever, with somebody who is just, you know, not even in the music business at all, and just, you know, trying to get his feet wet? How did you all hook up, and how did you all stay together, and what was your relationship? Were you his boss? Were you the one that ran things? Was it the other way around? How did that work?
Well, remember now that Eazy-E was one of the smartest people that I've ever met in my life. And I lay this whole thing on him. I didn't know who he was. He knew who I was. So he kept telling Alonzo Williams, who is one of my clients and the head of the World Class Wrecking Crew, of course, with Dr. Dre and Yella, and also CIA with Jinx and Ice Cube, were under his little company. Wasn't such a little company. So he kept telling Alonzo that he wanted to meet me, and Alonzo kept asking me to meet with him. And I said, what is this guy, your cousin or something, you know?
Now let me just ask you, just to not sidetrack, but you had already started getting involved with rap by then. How did that even come about?
Well, a guy named Maury Alexander called me one day, and he said, look, there's a little scene happening over at McCullough Records, which was a pressing plant down in Santa Monica. And I was very discouraged with the shape of the music business then, because unfortunately, the greatest album of the second half of the 20th century, Sgt. Pepper, set the bar so impossibly high for everybody else in rock and roll that it just made it changed the economics of the business. Albums start costing too much. Videos start costing too much. They kept trying to equal Sgt. Pepper. And it just, people were now being associated with records just because they cost a lot of money, not because they loved the records.
Right. Did Michael Jackson's Thriller change that at all, or was it Sgt. Pepper's the benchmark?
Oh, I think Sgt. Pepper was the first and really set the standard. So, because remember now, when you're talking about Sgt. Pepper, you're talking about everybody listening to a record. So, Maury told me about McColl. I went over there. It was just a little pressing plant. But at this pressing plant, for $1,000, you got 500 records with the artwork done. You took your records over to K-Day, which was a little 5,000-watt station at the top of Alvarado Street. You played it for Greg Mack and Julio's G and Tony G, the mix masters. And either they played it or they didn't. So, once again, what I call the economic integrity of the business was back in play. Now, you know, it was back to being a win-win situation, because if you were going to sell 20 or 25,000 units, everybody could make money. And that's the way the music business is supposed to be.
So now this is interesting, because what you're basically saying is that in the rap side, it was bringing it back to some sort of basics, and you found that the music business wasn't like that prior to coming into this burgeoning rap scene. And, you know, keeping in mind that on the West Coast, you had more of an independent scene and a more established situation back east.
Well, that's true. That's the way rock and roll started. So when I saw it happening again in rap, and specifically in gangster rap, I said, well, this can work. This is what it's supposed to be. This is why guys like Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan always play with smiles on their face, because the music business is a fun business. And just as an aside, I tell you that I think my book brings fun back to the music business. I think it's a fun book to read, and everybody seems to have fun reading it. And it is actually the real. But remember now, McCullough, we have Ice-T, we have MC Hammer, we have the Timex Social Club, we have the World Class Wrecking Crew, we have JJ Fad, we have the LA Dream Team, we have Bobby, Jimmy, and the Critters, we have Egyptian Lover, we have Rodney Owen, Joe Cooley. I mean, we have JJ Fad. So, I mean, these are all people pressing at McCullough. So we had a scene, and the thing beside the economic integrity that I love so much was I never particularly liked rap from the Bronx. Not that I didn't think it was important. Not that I didn't think it... Me, I'm a melody guy. I like musical kinds of songs, and it was more musical on the West Coast.
Well, there was that funk vibe in a lot of the music, and people like Egypt and others played keyboards, and Alonzo and others, and in the back home in New York, it seemed to be more sample-driven and drum-based.
And also, we had a little sense of humor out here. We didn't take ourselves quite so seriously. So I liked what was happening here, and I threw myself into it full force. So when I finally, Alonzo asked me for the 15th or 20th time to meet with this guy, Eric Wright, I said, look, I'm tired of meeting people that want to go into business with me. It's like, that's all I would do is take meetings. I'd be in the business of taking meetings to go into business. So he said, this guy's willing to pay me $750 to meet you, and I need the money. Or I could use the money. I don't know if he needed it. But I said, okay, tell him I'll be in McCullough on Tuesday or Thursday, whatever it was. It was March 3rd of 1987. It was a beautiful spring day. And up drives this this Suzuki Samurai. And he gets out with MC Ren. And there's a few other little rules that I have. You know, we're in a bullshit business, okay? It's bullshit, man. Not the music part, but the business part is bullshit. And people are always saying, I got this guy, and I got this girl, and I got this group, and this is my boy, and this is my... A
lot of hype.
Then it's bullshit, man. So I said to Easy, I said, do you have something to play me? And he said, yeah. And that's all he said. And this guy was clean, and he had presence, and he had charisma, and he was just clean, you know? He just exuded this kind of power. And all he said was, yeah. And you know something, man? In the final analysis, it's always the guys that let the music do the talking that are the successful kind of guys, not the guys that are talking about, I got this guy and that guy, and this is, you know, like I say, that's the bullshit part. The music part is the real part. And he was willing to let us, and we went inside. He put on Boys in the Hood. I heard it. I thought it was a combination of Gil Scott-Heron, The Last Poets, The Black Panthers, and The Rolling Stones all rolled into one. And since I was old enough to have experienced all of those things, I said, this is the most important music that I have heard since the beginning of rock and roll. And at that moment, you know, he and I struck a deal. He offered me a 50% partnership. I said, your idol's Berry Gordy. Why don't we keep it 100% totally black-owned company? And then no one will ever say about us the way they do Little Richard and Bo Diddley and those guys talk about guys ripping off their publishing and stuff like that. But here, we founded our company on that principle, and everyone wound up talking shit about us anyhow. So it's sort of ironic.
You know, well, there's a couple of things that came to mind. First, why did you think it was the most important record when you heard Boys in the Hood? And we're going to listen to that record in a minute.
It just blew me away. I mean, the Boys in the Hood are always hard, you know? Keep talking that shit and then punch your card. You know, I mean, just listen to it, man. I mean, that screams of the problems of our inner cities. And in a way that nobody had really told it before in a musical form. And, you know, it's just like everybody loved to ignore the problems of our inner cities, man. And here these guys were just shouting it out. Not only were they shouting it out, they weren't calling themselves New Kids on the Block. They were calling themselves N.W.A. In 1987, N.W.A., Niggas with Attitudes, man. And, like, Easy was sort of afraid to tell me what it stood for. So I said, so he was laughing, and I said, what's it stand for? No whites allowed? He said, well, that's sort of close enough, you know? So, I mean, this was a mind-boggling album, a mind-boggling concept, and Eazy-E turned out, as far as I'm concerned, to be the most important conceptualizer of the entire rap era. And I think that if he wouldn't have died of this unbelievably horrible illness, that today he would be the most important person in the music business.
Cruising down the street in my 6'4", jocking the freaks, clocking the dough, went to the park to get the scoop, knuckleheads out there, cold shooting some hoops. A car pulls up, who can it be? A fresh El Camino rolling Kilo G. He rolled down his window and he started to say, it's all about making that GTA. Cause the boys in the hood are always hard. You come talking to trash, we'll pull your car. Knowing nothing in life but to be legit. Don't quote me, boy, cause I ain't said shit. Trying to steal an Alpine. Chase him up the street to call a truce. The silly cluck head pulls out a deuce goose. Little did he know I had a loaded 12 gauge. One sucker dead, LA Times front page. Cause the boys in the hood are always hard. You come talking to trash, we'll pull your guard. Knowing nothing in life but to be legit. Don't quote me, boy, cause I ain't said shit.
We've been talking with Jerry Heller, getting a little bit of that background about Easy and the start of Ruthless Records. You know, you talk about Easy being conceptualized in the book. You also, you know, as you said here in the interview, that he's one of the smartest people that you ever met, that he came with a lot of keen understanding. What did both of you guys learn from each other? What did you think his strengths and weaknesses were, and what were yours as you guys did business together?
Easy was a conceptualizer. Ice Cube was a verbalizer, Dre was a musicalizer, and I was a financializer. So what Easy would do was, he would go over and Ice Cube would be writing his verse of Straight Outta Compton. And he would read it to Easy, and Easy would say, that's corny, this is the way it should be. He would do that with everybody. He could make you better than you were. And I've always said that as much as I like some of Ice Cube's stuff, America's Most Wanted, whatever, and as much as I think The Chronic is an important record, that nothing that any of them has ever done can equal what Chris Rock and Rolling Stone and what the LA Times have called the most important record of the second half of the 20th century, Straight Outta Compton. So, obviously, he brought something to the mix. And Ice Cube says, well, Easy didn't really write much. Dre says, well, Easy didn't really do much music. But he was able to make you more than you were yourself. I know that he did that for me. He made me more than I was myself.
So that's what I wanted to get clear. Now, when they wrote these things, I remember interviewing them early on. You know, I probably did one of their first interviews up in the Bay. And they, early on, were talking about that they were reporters. You know, so that they, you know, Cube was like, I didn't go through all this stuff, you know, and yeah, right, it's too young. And so was this based upon Easy's life? Was he coming in and saying, here are the war stories? Were these things that they saw? You know, Ren, I knew, probably experienced some of that. I mean, how did that whole thing work that they were able to get this this detail? And also want to add another thing. I remember Easy telling me that some of the stuff he just did because he thought it was funny. He liked the reaction. So I wanted to get your perspective on that from working with him.
I think that it was a combination of those things. I also think that of all the guys in NWA, he and Ren were probably the only real street guys. And Easy was a street guy. And at a very young age was reputed to be a drug dealer. And I think that during that period of Freeway Rick and Ricardo Crockett and Monster Cody and Harry O, I think that Eric was very young then. But I think that he saw and understood what it meant to have something that other people wanted to have. I think that the drug business is very analogous to a lot of businesses, and I think that he learned his street smarts. Like I said in the book, you know, either you're a player or an athlete or you're a drug dealer or you're a victim, and he certainly was no victim. So I think that he transformed that street knowledge that he had along with his innate Machiavellian sense of power. And the guy was just an incredible, incredible force. And like with me, he said to me, nobody is ever going to put their name on one of my records. It's always going to be ruthless. And I said, okay, but that isn't the way you start off. You start off, you do a record for somebody, and then if it's a hit, you know, I told him the traditional avenue that the music business takes. And he said to me, yeah, oh, that's great. But listen, nobody is ever going to put their name on one of my records, so don't even come to me with those kind of deals. So right away, he put me into a different mindset because I knew that he wasn't going to settle for anything less than what it is. And he was willing...
So he wasn't trying to get signed to a major, so to speak.
Not really. He just wanted his records to be out all over the world and to be, you know, with the finest of everything. And he drove me to make those kinds of deals, which I wouldn't have done on my own.
Now, I remember in the book you were talking about the fact that, you know, here you are, you know, these are your contemporaries, the people that are running these labels, all the big names, you know them, you've dealt with them, they know, you know, all that. And so you were making all these phone calls and none of them wanted to pick up on those records. And what were those conversations like and why didn't they see it, especially if they were coming out of the dawning of rock and roll as we know it, where it was pushing the envelope and you had the sex and drugs type of culture? Why did all these people turn down the offers that you were trying to bring for Ruthless to be a part of their operation?
First of all, I think the name NWA scared the hell out of them. That's number one. Number two, I went to Joe Smith, who was then the chairman of the board of Capitol Records and an old dear friend of mine. We had done Van Morrison together and lots of other groups, and I had nothing but the highest level of respect and still do for him. So I played him a song that started out, what the fuck is up, who the fuck is he, coming on the mic is easy motherfucking E. And then I started off the next song, straight out of Compton, crazy motherfucker named Ice Cube in a band called Niggas with Attitude. So he looked at me and he said, you know, Jerry, you got to stop getting high. He said, nobody will ever play this. Nobody will listen to it. Nobody will buy it. He said, I love the name Ruthless. He says, I'll give you a couple of $1 million for the name right now. It's the greatest name I ever heard. But anytime, if this music ever achieves success, I'll retire, which he did. But not, I'm sure not because of that. This is a very successful, terrific guy, Joe Smith. But I told him, I said, you know, Joe, I remember, and he was a disc jockey in Boston. I said, I remember when radio stations wouldn't play Let's Spend the Night Together by the Rolling Stones. I said, now Mick Jagger's Frank Sinatra. I said, times change. This is the music of the future, and it certainly is the voice of our inner cities.
We're going to take a break. If you hear the dogs barking in the background, I think, you got like 10 dogs in the house here or something? Yeah, so that's why. We're in their house, so we got to deal with them barking. So we're going to take a break, and we'll come back. We'll continue our conversation with Jerry Heller right here.
WBRKD. Breakdown FM. Where we break down news, views, and the hip-hop movements.